Hello and welcome to Lives and Times of the Judges, a series of interviews with former judges of the Federal Court of Australia. Today, I'm talking with the Honourable Michael Black, AC, KC and Chief Justice between 1991 and 2010. My first question is, what makes a good judge?
Oh, well, you can tell them when you see them. Look, it's hard to say. They're obviously foundational qualities, so of intellect, knowledge of the law, knowledge of life, technical abilities, preparedness to do hard work as needed. Some manage to get through an enormous amount of work in a short time. Others take longer. The thing is that you can do it. Then you've got to have a balance in your personality, I guess. You should have courtesy, ideally calm, courage as needed sometimes, understanding, empathy, all those qualities, as well as a very sound understanding of the law and capacity to analyse the law and arguments and come to the principled and correct decision. You know it when you see it, and you know that's what you hope for.
So once you become a judge, do you seek advice from other judges? Can you do that? Do you feel comfortable doing that? It must be quite hard once you're at the top of the tree, as it were.
Well, in a sense, one's very much on one's own. One has to decide according to one's own view, and one's conscience isn't quite the right word. You have to decide it as you see it. As far as discussion with other judges are concerned, well, that will depend on individuals. In some areas, the collegiate life of a court is extremely important. Cases can be decided, I mean, the collegiate discussion about the outcome, I think, is important. But, I mean, everyone has their own view about that. Some would say better to write your own judgments and then have the discussion. Others would say it's as it comes. But I think discussion with colleagues about the case is, I would have thought, is highly helpful. I'm talking about appellate courts now. As far as individual cases and individual problems are concerned, well, I guess we all have people we talk to and some we wouldn't.
The Federal Court was created in 1976 and sat for the first time on February the 1st, 1977. Its first Chief Justice was Sir Nigel Bowen.
One thing one noticed in the early days of the Federal Court was that it was distinctly polite. Sir Nigel's leadership was not only of innovation in how courts would run, but also it was notably polite. And that wasn't a universal matter way back in the late 70s. It certainly wasn't. There were some very abrasive, even, I'd say, bullying judges around all over the place. The new Federal Court under Sir Nigel was not like that.
One of the founding ideas of the Federal Court was that it would be an efficient court,
absolutely,
a court that things got
absolutely
done quickly in.
Efficient and polite and getting the job done. Yes, that was the founding philosophy. It would explore new ways, and it did.
There were two or three innovations that really speeded things up.
Well, Sir Nigel was innovative. Then we kept on process of innovation. One of the things that we did do was to introduce what we call the individual docket system. So cases would be allocated to a judge to take through to conclusion and to manage. But anyway, that went hand in hand with advancing technology. So that indeed was a reform.
And then there was the rocket docket system?
The rocket docket. Well, that was, if something was really urgent, you'd just pull out all the stops. And some judges were very good at dealing with that. And they just, you know, whizzed the thing through, mindful, of course, of the needs of justice, but, you know, glaring when you'd see huge trolley loads of lever-arched folders being wheeled into court.
You know. I know, because that's a pet hate of yours, isn't it? The large trolleys that used to trundle
yes,
everywhere.
Absolutely. They're laden with useless costs. Now, of course, documents are fundamental, but these were great trolleys of, and they'd be wheeled in, wheeled down William Street, wheeled into the court, and not referred to. So, look, it's an oversimplification, but the idea was to get to the heart of the matter and get on with it.
Now, we could go back a little bit and say, yes, there was some opposition to the creation of a federal court, wasn't there?
Yes. Oh, yes. At one stage, it was proposed to call it the Superior Court of Australia, and some of the states said, superior to what? And there was that sort of stuff. No, there was opposition. I remember it. Being at the bar at the time, it was a vision that wasn't universally embraced. It was argued that it would diminish the role of the state courts, which had federal jurisdiction and could hear federal cases. But it was a vision of the first Chief Justice in his capacity as Attorney General and others, Robert Ellicott. It's an interesting history. The 1970s were an era of substantial change, the expansion of Commonwealth legislative activity, particularly in areas that affected public at large, the development of administrative law in the Commonwealth sphere. It was an interesting era. And the other interesting thing is the first Chief Justice, Sir Nigel, he was, amongst his many other remarkable qualities, he was a great diplomat. And I use that in the nicest sense.
Go into the law in the first place? Were there any people in the law in your family? Did you come from a legal family in any way?
No, I didn't. It wasn't a legal family. My father was a military person. His father, whom I never met, died quite young, was an architect who practiced here and later in South Africa. I found the bar an extremely satisfying career, and particularly those moments when you are on your feet as an advocate, but also I think it's satisfying when you're planning the strategy of the case. Yeah, look, one had a practice that evolved from the little cases in the magistrates' court, courts of petty sessions, as we called them then, in the county court, some criminal cases, quite a few personal injury cases, quite a lot of those, before juries, and then gradually doing quite a lot of labour law cases, industrial law cases, and then gradually they get bigger and, I guess, in a sense, but only in a press-type sense, more important. They're all important to people involved. Well, nearly all important to the people involved. And, it just grows.
You sent me a piece you'd written which was about the country courtroom, the smaller cases and watching a magistrate dispense judgment in small communities and how those were influential as well.
Yes, I wrote a piece, and it's in a chapter in a book about court architecture, and I referred to the fine roots of the common law. The very finest roots can be found in country courthouses presided over by wise magistrates. Now, I didn't mean, and I made this clear later, that the magistrates directly made the common law, because, of course, they don't. Only the higher courts' judgments do that. But when you have sat as a young barrister in some of these country courthouses, just to take country courthouses as an example, with the mallee roots burning in the fireplace, cold winter's day, some awfully tragic case being dealt with humanely and sensibly and justly by an experienced, decent country magistrate, you learn about the common law, you learn about being a judge.
In 1983, as a QC, Michael Black was involved in the Commonwealth versus Tasmania, a landmark case both for conservation and for Australian constitutional law. You've been involved in several very big issues in your long career. And of course, another one that springs to mind is the Tasmanian Dam case. It was a case that completely split the country, wasn't it? Tell us a bit about the background to the Tasmanian Dam case and your involvement in it.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I had taken Silk a year or two earlier. I had a very broad practice doing all sorts of things. I did a lot of work in the High Court. Very diverse practice, not particularly associated with the environment. I had, however, and this may have had something to do with it, many years earlier I had been involved in quasi-political campaign to preserve the landscape of the Royal Botanic Gardens near where at that stage we lived. It was proposed all sorts of high-rise developments which would have ruined the landscape. I learnt a lot about things in that work. It wasn't dramatic. There were no protests and things, but it was good local government work. And I don't know whether that had anything to do with it. I'd also appeared for Project Jonah in their submission to the inquiry to look into whales and whaling, which ended up banning it. Maybe they thought that was something, a useful background, I don't know. So all of a sudden, about 3 or 4 weeks before the case was called on, a brief arrived from Pierre Slicer, solicitor in Hobart. So that's how that happened.
So you were representing the Tasmanian Wilderness Society?
Yes, I was. Yeah, they were applying for leave to intervene in the case. And my junior was Brian Keon Cohen, who was Ron Caston's junior in Mabo No. 2.
This case really, it split the country, but it especially split Tasmania between those who felt that the Tasmanian government should have the ultimate say in what happened to its, you know, plans for hydroelectricity.
This was Tasmania, and the Commonwealth legislation was saying, well, you can't do this in Tasmania. It was a serious constitutional conflict, resolved, as we know, in favour of the use of the external affairs power and treaties and corporations. There's no doubt passions were... I was at a conference about the case many years later, and someone was describing how there would be Sunday lunches in which people would be in tears and doors would be slammed and families would be fighting each other. Very sad and awful. Understandable, I guess. Tasmanian Dam case, of course, was very important, no doubt about that. But I was looking through some old records. I mean, there were lots and lots of them. There was a case, for example, brought to the defence of government schools, tried to change the way in which non-government schools were supported. There are a whole range of these cases. There's a wonderful one here, Knowles and the Queen. I think it was the first successful petition of mercy in Australian legal history. A man had been convicted of murder, lost his appeal, but there was something wrong with the conviction. And I led a team where we had that conviction set aside, and he died shortly afterwards, but he died a free man. That was moving and important. There were just lots and lots. A wonderful case I see here, the Commonwealth of Australia against Anthony John Fisher. It was a case, would you believe, about pieces of eight. You know, pieces of eight in pirate stories?
Yes, absolutely.
And the Vergul Drake had gone down, I think in the 17th century, off the coast of Western Australia, and someone had found it and got the pieces of eight and gone away with them. And then they ended up, I mean, this was fabulous fun. The pieces of eight ended up as security for costs in a criminal case run by a criminal law solicitor. And the Commonwealth wanted the pieces of eight back. Can you imagine?
What year was this?
About 1984, 85. So my junior, Chris Jessop, and I said, well, we better have an inspection. We better see these pieces of eight. So they were in a bank vault, and we all assembled to see them, and they were in a chest. You know, it wasn't a pirate's chest, but we'll call it a chest. It was a big box. And they opened it up, and there were the pieces of eight. And I couldn't resist it. I plunged my hands into this chest and let the pieces of eight tinker around back into the chest, saying as I did so, a bit of doidry, that sound me out is. Well, the Treasury officials wrote down what I'd said. They didn't get the joke, and I've enjoyed it ever since. So forgive that conceit, I hope. Anyway, we ultimately, of course, got our order. I'm not sure what happened to the client who handed over the pieces of eight, but we got them back. And I think they're now in the West Australian Museum. It was great. I mean, those are the sort of fun cases one did.
In Michael Black's long career, he has accumulated a range of mementos, objects that tell their own story about his legal interests and changes over the decades.
One of the most precious things is this Olivetti La Terra 22 manual portable typewriter. It's quite heavy, but it must have travelled thousands and thousands of kilometres on cases that I did at the bar. I taught myself to type during my, I'd like to call my gap year, my year as a shipping clerk. I actually got a shorthand and typing book. I taught myself to type. Huge advantage, because my writing's horrible. And this is the typewriter that I had in those days. You could pay someone $2 a page to type your stuff, or you could do it yourself, or both. Anyway, this travelled around. Whether this is the device that I used the night before the final day in the dams case to type the two-page submissions, or whether it was then the new electronic portable, which was very fashionable, I can't say. But certainly this one typed out lots and lots of stuff. Boring interrogatories at the weekend, opinions, stuff that I needed to do at once. So it's a precious artifact in my career.
So are you very handy around a laptop these days?
I can type very quickly, but the IT, I need geeks. Okay. So that's that one. And that's precious. These, now here's a file. It's engraved on the handle to Black from the rank and file. Now this goes back to my time as foundation chair of the Bar Readers Course in Victoria. The Bar Readers Course was founded in the early 1980s for incoming members of the bar. They had to do the Readers Course, which I think then was 3 months.
And were you one of the people who started it?
Well, George Hampel was one of them, and I was another, and I was the chair of the Reader's Course, so I was its sort of daily leader. I used to give some lectures in it and was the general practical head of it.
What's this letter that you received from the readers?
This letter accompanied the gold bag. Have I shown you that?
You see it sitting on the end of the sofa. It looks very showbiz.
So, as you know, junior barristers have a blue bag and silks have a red bag, which some people even took on aircraft and threw them into the luggage rack to show off. I don't think I ever did that, but it has one's initials on them. Red bags are something that you can give to a junior if they've been brilliant in a case, and it's a great mark of within the bar. I did give a couple of red bags that way. So that's the red bag. And I guess probably in these chats that one had to introduce people to the bar and its customs, most of which have a purpose, actually, a purpose of collegiality and in a sense, self-care for your opponent. You want to beat him or her, but equally they are comrades. So all that type of thing. And I think it seemed to have impressed this lot of readers, because one day, this is one of the early courses, this is a lovely note, it's of course handwritten, Black, it says, in accordance with tradition, bracket, newly instituted in your absence, close bracket, I would like you to accept on behalf of the readers this bag as a mark of the esteem in which you are held by the CAP Readers Course, September 1983, yours sincerely, and it's signed, Chairman of the Self-Appointed Readers Course Group Award Committee. And it's a lovely thing, and I used to hang it on my doorknob in my chambers next to my red bag and my blue bag, and that was just part of the eccentricities and amusements of the bar.
So is there anyone else in existence with a gold bag?
No other gold bag. Well, not as far as I know. But even if there were, it could not be as showbiz, as vulgar and as gorgeous as this one. It's a marvellous creation. So there.
So tell us a little bit about those beads that you have there.
Yes,
where did you get them?
Sent to me up in Madang. by a magistrate, and they have cultural significance. I rather treasure them. When I was Chief Justice, we had close relationships with the judiciary in PNG and indeed elsewhere in the Pacific, and those have been developed and continued since. They've been very much a mark of the federal court's work in the region. So all that was going on. It was quite dynamic. Indonesia, Vietnam, Pacific Islands, PNG, across Tasman with New Zealand.
Was it a two-way street? Were you learning from Indonesians or yes, Vietnamese?
We were learning about culture. We're learning about our neighbours. And indeed, for a while, we actually had courses in Bahasa for judges.
Back in the 1970s, when the federal court was formed, it was hearing slightly different cases from today, wasn't it? It was more about trade practices then and industrial law and the expansion of native title of cases have really expanded in the last 30, 40 years.
Yes, that is so. Native title was a remarkable new jurisdiction which the court embraced and in respect of which the court adopted some remarkably innovative procedures. Within a short time of the Native Title Act being enacted, the court was sitting literally in the desert, in places which had no whitefella name, but well known to the people whose cases we were hearing. And we rapidly sat on country. The court sat with a degree of formality, but on folding chairs, and there were other innovations. We started to hear evidence by way of dance and song and indeed group evidence. But this was justice being done out in on country, some of it in the desert, some of it notably up in the Torres Strait Islands, all over the place, and remarkable stuff. My own case is basically consent determination, so they were nothing compared to what some of my colleagues did. But they were extremely revealing and deeply moving. I sat on the consent determination that granted native title over two little islands. This is in the Torres Strait. This is off Murray Island, and the two little islands, Weir and Dower. And there were some difficulties about that. Anyway, the consent determination was made, and we sat in the rainforest on a bench that was garlanded with flowers. There were remarkable songs beforehand. They had to stop, for the formal court hearing. And the moment the court was closed, after the hearing, they started again and danced, and it was an amazing experience.
In August 2001, Michael Black was one of three federal court judges who heard an appeal on behalf of the government to deny access to a group of refugees seeking asylum in Australia, a widely reported episode that became known as the Tampa Affair. It revealed both the federal court's efficiency and its openness.
Tampa, of course, was as a judge, so I think it's okay to talk about the background to it. Because what happened was, as we know, the Tampa intercepted a boat full of refugees. The boat, I think, was sinking. Tampa took them on board. And then they were transferred to a naval vessel, HMAS Manura. And an injunction application was made to the court. It was heard immediately by Justice North, who delivered judgment on the 11th of September 2001, 9/11. That night, the Twin Towers came down. I was Chief Justice at the time. We were worried that this building was a possible target. We didn't know what was going to happen. But we heard the appeal. We convened a bench of the three most senior available judges so there could be no question of anything, Bob French and Brian Beaumont. We sat and heard the appeal. If the judge was to favour the refugees, it had to be delivered before the ship got out of the jurisdiction. So it was extremely urgent. So we heard the appeal. We started on the judgment immediately. We worked on it all weekend and we're in a position to deliver judgment, though not, I think, the reasons on the Monday. I delivered them the following day. By a majority, the appeal was allowed, and there was no injunction to stop the in favour of the refugees. I was the dissenter. I think, too, that was an important case because we had a judgment summary, which I was very keen on, so that people could understand the essence of the decision. And we televised that, televised the delivery of the summary, which was innovative and probably very good in those times of peril and anxiety.
Alongside presiding over the federal court, one of the lasting legacies of Michael Black's 19 years as Chief Justice is architectural. In addition to taking a keen interest in the building of new Commonwealth law courts in Adelaide and modifications and renovations to courthouses in Hobart and Sydney, Justice Black was enthusiastically involved in the creation of a new Commonwealth law court building in his hometown. We're sitting here at the Federal Court building on the corner of Latrobe Street and William Street in the heart of Melbourne. And this building is, in many respects, your baby, isn't it, Judge?
Sort of, but not really.
Many people do actually ascribe a lot of the ideas and the drive to get it happening to you.
Well, that's kind of them. Certainly it was something that I was very keen to see happen in the interests of the court. Took office on the 1st of January 1991, and one of my first projects was to get the buildings underway. The old High Court building at that stage, classical and delightful and important though it is, was then a mess. There was stuff running down the walls. It was in a bad shape. It needed a lot of work done, and it wasn't yet to be suitable for an enlarging federal court.
The Melbourne architect firm Hassells were appointed to design this building, but you had a very strong idea about the philosophy of the building, didn't you?
Yes, Hassells were the architects, and they did a wonderful job. But the process of developing them was cooperative, collegiate, and really extremely satisfying. But it started off with some ideas that are broadly reflected in the ultimate ideas, which then went into the design brief. The interesting thing about it is that it was conceived as something different. It was conceived as a new approach to courthouse architecture. The concepts date back to 1991. Then they were refined collegially through a committee and then through this great, what I call the great live-in two-day meeting at which the architects knew what we wanted and translated what we wanted into the concept that is now the building. And I think that's a very interesting commentary about the creative process, which of course is involved in the law just as much as it is in architecture. I mean, different in many ways, but likewise there has to be a process of putting together ideas and interchange of ideas and disciplines and so forth. Now, just as a matter of interest, it might be interesting to see what the overriding concepts were, and these were as follows. Firstly, the building should reflect the importance of the system of justice, but also, and I notice that's underlined, its transparency and accessibility, yes. Be full of light and have external views, yes. Be dignified but not intimidating. I don't think it's intimidating, but I think it is dignified. Invite the public into the building to see their system of justice at work. Yes. The next dot point is that it should be egalitarian, such that all the users and occupiers would have access to natural light, views and facilities. So that, of course, includes judges' staff, and especially not least registry staff. Third last point, should contain works of art that would be part of the building, not additions to it afterwards. We didn't use the term at the time, but I think that's a Bauhaus concept. They're actually part of the building. And I think the architects did achieve that, and the artists, especially with my favourite door, the Duccio di Buonsegna door. I think it's wonderful. I mean, it's not a door, it's a work of art. And also, incidentally, it's a very fine backdrop for television commentaries.
Describe it for people who are listening but don't know it. This door is in the entranceway, isn't it?
Yes, it is in the entranceway. It's huge, but not domineering. It swings, it pivots on a hydraulic system, and it has panels of enameled metal in different shades that reflect this great early Renaissance painter's use of colour. They're also very good to touch. But anyway, that's another big topic. The second last point was it should be Australian in concept and materials. Yes, that's so. Also, one of the concepts was it should be a Melbourne building, so the materials do reflect Melbourne colours. And finally, it should be energy efficient and ecologically sound. Well, yes, maybe could be improved in that sense, but that was the aim.
Now, I'm looking at the windows, and when we step away, of course, you can see that the bottom panels have part of the Constitution printed on them.
So the architect, Paul Katsiris, he said that courts are words, and maybe they should be veiled with words. And you do find that. You find in the French courts, liberté, égalité, etc. And in Italian courts, la legge è uguale per tutti, that these sort of symbols, and the United States too. So what words? Well, I recommended, and it was generally agreed, the sections of the Constitution of chapters 1, 2 and 3 that create the judicial power of the Commonwealth and enable the establishment of the Federal Court of Australia. It's not the whole Constitution. It's so much of the Constitution as would empower the Parliament of the Commonwealth to create the Federal Court, and of course also of its own nature, creates the High Court, which is created by the Constitution itself. Federal Court is created by the Parliament under the Constitution. So it's all there, separation of powers, judicial authority, everything.
Let's go and have a little bit of a look.
We're proceeding north along Level 8.
There's your portrait. You're looking very severe.
Yes, I think so. Robert Hannaford, I mean, he's a brilliant portraitist. There's another one in Sydney, similar, by the same artist. There's another one, though, that the bar has, by Louise Hearman, and that's an advocate's portrait. That's me as an advocate.
That's interesting, because, of course, as a judge, you have to look very decisive and implacable and... You know.
One hopes so. and the robes, of course, are important, the Federal Court robes.
Now, here we are outside court number one.
Every courtroom's important, but this one is where the major public events take place. If there's an appeal, it's generally heard in court one. If it's an important case, can be heard here. But especially the great occasions of the law and of the court, judicial welcomes, swearing in, taking the oath of office, the oath of allegiance, often take place here, if they haven't already, and then judicial farewells. And another ceremony that I find quite moving is when the new Sooks, come and announce their appointment as King's Counsel. Now, that takes place here. It's an important part of the court's function and also symbolism.
The doors are rather large, aren't they? And this is something that you were very keen on when it was being designed,
well,
I believe.
The essence of what I was keen on was that when there are large gatherings, people wanting to see their relatives take the oath and matters of this nature, that as many people as possible should be able to witness it. So my idea was that you have a big sliding door so that all of a sudden the space enlarges enormously. For architectural reasons, a sliding door wasn't possible. The architects designed a two-part door. One is large and impressive, but not huge, and the other one is really very large.
The main door is rather monumental, mainly because of this magnificent doorknob.
It's a work of art, and it was created by Rodney Broad, who was the sculptor who created the coat of arms over the main bench. It represents the Victorian white Waratah, and there's the coat of arms of Australia.
Now, there are other aspects to this courtroom as well that are rather special. Now, I believe the lectern is very important.
Yes, it was made specifically for this courtroom. It's commissioned by the court from Damien Wright, noted craftsman in wood. As you see, it's a striking piece, very functional. It's made of mineralised river redgum, Eucalyptus camaldulensis. The tree from which this is made grew about 10,000 years ago on the banks of the River Murray, or a tributary, at the edge of Yorta Yorta country. It fell into the water, would have been covered up, and modern times harvested as timber.
Now, the public come in through those doors, but the judges, they don't. They come in through a special corridor. Can we go down the passageway?
Yes, we can. I want to do a little thing about the mirrors and the way that goes the view comes through into the courtroom. This part of the building, it's a very difficult site. So you've got office buildings there. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to bring the view up this space between the two buildings to bring the view of the park into the court. But then the problem was, people will see the judges in the private corridor, we can't have that. So first of all, we tested the mirrors, and yes, that does bring the view in. So then I learnt that rich Californians in their bathrooms had sheets of glass that would go opaque if someone was in the bath. So I said, well, can we get some of these? And the architect said, oh, ripper, let's go. You see the sensor up there? That's meant to make these opaque if any human. Now, that was, I think, ingenious.
That is so clever, because also the view is beautiful. The use of the mirrors really gives a calming view to people who will most likely be rather anxious and agitated.
It was another design idea. So to keep the right atmosphere, it doesn't need to be military.
No. Excellent.
So there we are. I think that explains it.
I think it does. Shall we go to chambers?
Yes. Nice one. To progress to the lifts. So
what kind of reception has this federal court building received from other quarters?
It did receive a lot of acclaim. Notably, Justice Stephen Breyer, formerly Justice, of course, of the Supreme Court of the United States, 1994 to 2022, I gave them a tour with Justice Tony Scalia. Justice Breyer, he said it was fabulous. Now, he had a particular interest in architecture, because he was responsible for the great federal court building in Boston. And I noticed he's now chairman of the Pritzker Prize Committee, so he knows what he's talking about. Anyway, he said that it was one of the great courthouses of the world. After my retirement from the bench, I gave a tour of the building to L.B. Sachs, formerly Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa. He said that he thought it was outstanding, and he was very enthusiastic about it. I think he named it as one of the tops. And the other one that I got a lot of pleasure from, I got to know through various things, the noted French jurist and commentator Antoine Garapon, and broadcaster too. He came on a tour of the court, and during the view, he would quite frequently say, formidable. And we had about six or seven formidables. So there we are. It's nice to hear people today still saying that they like it.
Well, formidable indeed. Thank you very much, Michael Black. Thank you.
All right.